There were 100 ounces Lothar could have given, and they crowded to his lips. Once, many years ago, I saved you and your mother from death in the desert. I helped wean you and carried you on the pommel of my saddle when you were a baby. I loved you almost as much as I once loved your mother. You are Manfred's brother. You are half-brother to my own son. I'd recognize you anywhere, even after all this time. But instead, he said, Chasse is the Bushman word for good water, the most precious substance in the Bushman world. That's right, Chasse Courtney nodded. The man interested him. There was a restrained violence and cruelty in him, an impression of untapped strength, and his eyes were strangely light-coloured, almost yellow, like those of a cat. You're right. It's a Bushman name, but my Christian name is Michel. That's French. My mother is French. Where is she? Lothar demanded, and Chasse glanced at the office door. She doesn't want to be disturbed, he warned, but Lothar de la Rey stepped past him so closely that Chasse could smell the fish slime on his oilskins and see the small white fish scales stuck to his tanned skin. You'd best knock, Chasse dropped his voice, but Lothar ignored him and flung the door of the office open so that it crashed back on its hinges. He stood in the open door, and Chasse could see past him. His mother rose from the straight-backed chair by the window and faced the door. She was slim as a girl, and the yellow crepe de chine of her dress was draped over her small, fashionably flattened breasts and was gathered in a narrow girdle low around her hips. Her narrow-brimmed cloche hat was pulled down, covering the dense, dark bush of her hair, and her eyes were huge and almost black. She looked very young, not much older than her son, until she raised her chin and showed the hard, determined line of her jaw, and the corners of her eyes lifted also, and those honey-coloured lights burned in their dark depths. Then she was formidable as any man Lothar had ever met. They stared at each other, assessing the changes that the years had wrought since their last meeting. How old is she? Lothar wondered, and then immediately remembered. She was born an hour after midnight on the first day of the century. She is as old as the 20th century. That's why she was named Santaine. So she's 31 years old, and she still looks 19. As young as the day I found her, bleeding and dying in the desert, were the wounds of lion claws deep in her sweet young flesh. He has aged, Santaine thought. Those silver streaks in the blonde, those lines around the mouth and eyes. He'll be over 40 now, and he has suffered, but not enough. I am glad I didn't kill him. I'm glad my bullet missed his heart. It would have been too quick. Now he is in my power, and he'll begin to learn the true. Suddenly, against her will and inclination, she remembered the feel of his golden body over hers, naked and smooth and hard, and her loins clenched and then dissolved, so that she could feel their hot, soft flooding, as hot as the blood that mounted to her cheeks, and as hot as her anger against herself and her inability to master that animal corner of her emotions. In all other things, she had trained herself like an athlete, but always that unruly streak of sensuality was just beyond her control. She looked beyond the man in the doorway, and she saw Chasse standing out in the sunlight, her beautiful child, watching her curiously. And she was ashamed and angry to have been caught in that naked and unguarded moment when she was certain that her basest feelings had been on open display. "Close the door," she ordered, and her voice was husky and level. "Come in and close the door." She turned away and stared out of the window, bringing herself under complete control once more before turning back to face the man she had set herself to destroy. The door closed, and Shasta suffered an acute pang of disappointment. He sensed that something vitally important was taking place. That blonde stranger with the cat-yellow eyes, who knew his name and its derivation, stirred something in him, something dangerous and exciting. Then his mother's reaction, that sudden high colour coming up in her throat, into her cheeks, and something in her eyes that he had never seen before. Not guilt, surely. Then uncertainty, which was totally uncharacteristic. She had never been uncertain of anything in the world that Shasta knew of. He wanted desperately to know what was taking place behind that closed door. The walls of the building were of corrugated galvanized iron sheeting. "If you want to know something, go and find out." It was one of his mother's adages, and his only compunction was that she might catch him at it as he crossed to the side wall of the office, stepping lightly so that the gravel would not crunch under his feet, and laid his ear against the sun-heated, corrugated metal. Though he strained, he could only hear the murmur of voices. Even when the blonde stranger spoke sharply, he could not catch the words, while his mother's voice was low and husky and inaudible. "The window," he thought, and moved quickly to the corner. As he stepped around it, intent on eavesdropping at the open window, he was suddenly the subject of attention of 50 pairs of eyes. The factory manager and his idle workers were still clustered at the main doors, and they fell silent and turned their full attention upon him as he appeared round the corner. Shasta tossed his head and veered away from the window. They were all still watching him, and he thrust his hands into the pockets of his Oxford bags, and, with an elaborate show of nonchalance, sauntered down towards the long wooden jetty, as though this had been his intention all along. Whatever was going on in the office now was beyond him, unless he could wheedle it out of his mother later, and he didn't think there was much hope of that. Then suddenly he noticed the four squat wooden trawlers moored alongside the jetty, each lying low in the water under the glittering silver cargo they carried. And his disappointment was a little mollified. Here was something to break the monotony of his hot, dreary desert afternoon, and his step quickened as he went onto the timbers of the jetty. Boats always fascinated him. This was new and exciting. He had never seen so many fish. There must be tons of them. He came level with the first boat. It was grubby and ugly, with streaks of human excrement down the sides where the crew had squatted on the gunwale, and it stank of bilges and fuel oil, and unwashed humanity living in confined quarters. It had not even been graced with a name. There were only the registration and license numbers painted on the wave-battered bows. "A boat should have a name," Shasta thought. "It's insulting and unlucky not to give it a name." His own 25-foot yacht that his mother had given him for his 13th birthday was named the Midas Touch, a name that his mother had suggested. Shasta wrinkled his nose at the smell of the trawler, disgusted and saddened by her disgracefully neglected condition. If this is what Mater drove all the way from Windhoek for... He did not finish the thought, for a boy stepped around the far side of the tall, angular wheelhouse. He wore patched shorts of canvas duck. His legs were brown and muscled, and he balanced easily on the hatch combing on bare feet. As they became aware of each other, both boys bridled and stiffened, like dogs meeting unexpectedly. Silently they scrutinized each other. "A dandy, a fancy boy," Manfred thought. He had seen one or two like him on their infrequent visits to the resort down of Swakopmund up the coast. Rich men's children, dressed in ridiculous stiff clothing, walking dutifully behind their parents with that infuriating supercilious expression upon their faces. Look at his hair, all shiny with brilliantine, and he stinks like a bunch of flowers. One of the poor white Afrikaners. Shasta recognized his type. A bivoner, a squatter's kid. His mother had forbidden him to play with them, but he had found that some of them were jolly good fun. Their attraction was, of course, enhanced by his mother's prohibition. One of the sons of the machine shop foreman at the mine imitated bird calls in such an amazingly lifelike manner that he could actually call the birds down from the trees. And he had shown Sasha how to adjust the carburetor and ignition on the old Ford which his mother allowed him to use, even though he was too young to have a driver's license. While the same boy's elder sister, a year older than Shasta, had shown him something even more remarkable when they had shared a few forbidden moments together behind the pump house at the mine. She had even allowed him to touch it, and it had been warm and soft and furry as a newborn kitten cuddling up there under her short cotton skirt. A most remarkable experience which he intended to repeat at the very next opportunity. This boy looked interesting also. Perhaps he could show Shasta over the trawler's engine room. Shasta glanced back at the factory. His mother was not watching, and he was prepared to be magnanimous. Hello! He made a lordly gesture and smiled carefully. His grandfather, Sir Garrick Courtney, the most important male person in his existence, was always admonishing him, "By birth you have a specially exalted position in society. This gives you not only benefit and privilege, but a duty also. A true gentleman treats those beneath his station, black or white, old or young, man or woman, with consideration and courtesy." "My name is Courtney," Shasta told him. Shasta Courtney. "My uncle is Sir Garrick Courtney, and my mother is Mrs. Santaine de la Thierry Courtney." He waited for the deference that those names usually commanded, and when it was not evident, he went on, rather lamely, "What's your name?" "My name is Manfred," the other boy replied in Afrikaans, and arched those dense black eyebrows over the amber eyes. They were so much darker than his streaked blonde hair that they looked as though they had been painted on. "Manfred de la Rey, and my grandfather, and my great-uncle, and my father, were de la Rey also, and they shot the shit out of the English every time they met them." Shasta blushed at this unexpected attack and was on the point of turning away when he saw that there was an old man leaning in the window of the wheelhouse watching them, and two coloured crewmen had come up from the trawler's forecastle. He could not retreat. "We English won the war, and in 1914 we beat the hell out of the rebels," he snapped. "We?" Manfred repeated, and turned to his audience. "This little gentleman with perfume on his hair won the war." The crewman chuckled encouragement. "Smell him. His name should be Lily. Lily the perfumed soldier." Manfred turned back to him, and for the first time Shasta realized that he was taller by a good inch, and his arms were alarmingly thick and brown. "So you are English, are you, Lily? Then you must live in London. Is that right, sweet Lily?" Shasta had not expected a poor white boy to be so articulate, nor his wit to be so acerbic. Usually he was in control of any discussion. "Of course I'm English," he affirmed furiously, and was seeking a final retort to end the exchange and allow him to retire in good order from a situation over which he was swiftly losing control. "Then you must live in London," Manfred persisted. "I live in Cape Town." "Ha!" Manfred turned to his growing audience. Svart Hendrik had come across the jetty from his own trawler, and all the crew were up from the forecastle. "That's why they are called Soot Peel," Manfred announced. There was an outburst of delighted guffaws at the coarse expression. Manfred would never have used it if his father had been present. The translation was salt prick, and Chasseur flushed and instinctively bunched his fists at the insult. "A Soot Peel has one foot in London and the other in Cape Town," Manfred explained with relish. "And his willy-wagger dangling in the middle of the salty old Atlantic Ocean." "You'll take that back." Anger had robbed Chasseur of a more telling rejoinder. He had never been spoken to in this fashion by one of his inferiors. "Take it back? You mean like you pull back your salty foreskin when you play with it? Is that what you mean?" Manfred asked. The applause had made him reckless, and he had moved closer, directly under the boy on the jetty. Chasseur launched himself without warning, and Manfred had not anticipated that so soon. He had expected to trade a few more insults before they were both sufficiently worked up to attack each other. Chasseur dropped 6 feet and hit him with the full weight of his body and his outrage. The wind was driven out of Manfred's lungs in a whoosh as, locked together, they went flying backwards into the morass of dead fish. They rolled over, and with a shock, Chasseur felt the other boy's strength. His arms were as hard as timber bulks, and his fingers felt like iron butcher's hooks as he clawed for Chasseur's face. Only surprise and Manfred's winded lungs saved him from immediate humiliation. And almost too late, he remembered the admonitions of Jock Murphy, his boxing instructor. "Don't let a bigger man force you to fight close. Fight him off. Keep him at arm's length." Manfred was clawing at his face, trying to get an arm around him in a half Nelson, and they were floundering into the cold, slippery mass of fish. Chasseur brought up his right knee, and as Manfred reared up over him, he drove it into his chest. Manfred gasped and reeled back, but then, as Chasseur tried to roll away, he lunged forward again for the headlock. Chasseur ducked his head and with his right hand forced Manfred's elbow up to break the grip. Then, as Jock had taught him, he twisted out against the opening he had created. He was helped by the fish slime that coated his neck and Manfred's arm like oil. And the instant he was free, he threw a punch with his left hand. Jock had drilled him endlessly on the short, straight left. "The most important punch you'll ever use." It wasn't one of Chasseur's best, but it caught the other boy in the eye with sufficient force to snap his head back and distract him just long enough to let Chasseur get onto his feet and back away. By now, the jetty above them was crowded with coloured trawlermen in rubber boots and blue roll-neck jerseys. They were roaring with delight and excitement, egging on the two boys as though they were gamecocks. Blinking the tears out of his swelling eye, Manfred went after Chasseur. But the fish clinging to his legs hampered him, and that left shot out again. There was no warning. It came straight and hard and unexpectedly, stinging his injured eye so that he shouted with anger and groped wildly for the lighter boy. Chasseur ducked under his arm and fired the left again, just the way Jack had taught him. "Never telegraph it by moving the shoulders or the head." He could almost hear Jock's voice. "Just shoot it with the arm alone." He caught Manfred in the mouth, and immediately there was blood as Manfred's lip was crushed under his own teeth. The sight of his adversary's blood elated Chasseur, and the concerted bellow of the crowd evoked a primeval response deep within him. He used the left again, cracking it into the pink swollen eye. "When you mark him, then keep hitting the same spot," Jock's voice in his head, And Manfred shouted again, but this time he could hear the pain as well as the rage in the sound. "It's working," Schasser exulted. But at that moment he ran backwards into the wheelhouse, and Manfred, realizing his opponent was cornered, rushed at him through the slimy fish, spreading both arms wide, grinning triumphantly, his mouth full of blood from his cut lip, and his teeth dyed bright pink. In panic, Schasser dropped his shoulders, braced himself for an instant against the wheelhouse timbers, and then shot forward, butting the top of his head into Manfred's stomach. Once again, Manfred wheezed as the air was forced up his throat, and for a few confused seconds they writhed together in the mess of pilchards, with Manfred gurgling for breath and unable to get a hold on his opponent's slippery limbs. Then Schasser wriggled away and half crawled, half swam to the foot of the wooden ladder of the jetty and dragged himself onto it. The crowd was laughing and booing derisively as he fled, and Manfred clawed angrily after him, spitting blood and fish slime out of his injured mouth, his chest heaving violently to refill his lungs. Schasser was halfway up the ladder when Manfred reached up and grabbed his ankle, pulling both his feet off the rungs. Schasser was stretched out by the heavier boy's weight, like a victim on the rack, clinging with desperate strength to the top of the ladder, and the faces of the coloured fishermen were only inches from his own as they leaned over the jetty and howled for his blood, favouring their own. With his free leg, Schasser kicked backwards, and his heel caught Manfred in his swollen eye. He yelled and let go, and Schasser scrambled up onto the jetty and looked around him wildly. His fighting ardour had cooled, and he was trembling. His escape down the jetty was open, and he longed to take it. But the men around him were laughing and jeering, and pride shackled him. He glanced around, and with a surge of dismay that was so strong that it almost physically nauseated him, he saw that Manfred had reached the top of the ladder. Schasser was not quite sure how he had got himself into this fight, or what was the point at issue, and miserably he wished he could extricate himself. That was impossible. His entire breeding and training precluded it. He tried to stop himself trembling as he turned back to face Manfred again. The bigger boy was trembling also, but not with fear. His face was swollen and dark red with killing rage, and he was making an unconscious hissing sound through his bloody lips. His damaged eye was turning purplish mauve and puffing into a narrow slit. "Kill him, Client Bassi!" screamed the coloured trawlerman. "Murder him, little boss!" And their taunts rallied Schasser. He took a deep steadying breath and lifted his fists into the classic boxer's stance, left foot leading and his hands held high in front of his face. "Keep moving," he heard Jock's advice again, and he went up on his toes and danced. "Look at him," the crowd hooted. "He thinks he's Jack Dempsey. He wants to dance with you, Manny. Show him the Walvis Bay Waltz." However, Manfred was daunted by the desperate determination in those dark blue eyes and by the clenched white knuckles of Schasser's left hand. He began to circle him, hissing threats. "I'm going to rip your arm off and stick it down your throat. I'm going to make your teeth march out of your backside like soldiers." Schasser blinked but kept his guard up, turning slowly to face Manfred as he circled. Though both of them were soaked and glistening with fish slime, and their hair was thick with the gelatinous stuff and speckled with loose scales, there was nothing ludicrous nor childlike about them. It was a good fight and promised to become even better, and the audience gradually fell silent. Their eyes glittered like those of a wolf pack, and they craned forward expectantly to watch the ill-matched pair. Manfred feinted left and then charged and rushed from the side. He was very fast, despite his size and the heaviness of his legs and shoulders. He carried his shining blonde head low and the black curved eyebrows emphasized the ferocity of his scowl. In front of him, Chasseur seemed almost girlishly fragile. His arms were slim and pale, and his legs, under the sodden grey flannel, seemed too long and thin. But he moved well on them. He dodged Manfred's charge, and as he pulled away, his left arm shot out again, and Manfred's teeth clicked audibly at the punch, and his head was flicked back as he was brought up on his heels. The crowd growled, "Vatom, Manny, get him!" And Manfred rushed in again, throwing a powerful roundhouse punch at Chasseur's pale, petal-smooth face. Chasseur ducked under it, and in the instant that Manfred was screwed off balance by his own momentum, stabbed his left fist unexpectedly and painfully into the purple, puffed-up eye. Manfred clasped his hand over the eye and snarled at him, "Fight properly, you cheating sooty!" "Yah!" a voice called from the crowd. "Stop running away! Stand and fight like a man!" At the same time, Manfred changed his tactics. Instead of feinting and weaving, he came straight at Chasseur and kept on coming, swinging with both hands in a terrifying mechanical sequence of blows. Chasseur fell back frantically, ducking and swaying and dodging, at first stabbing out with his left hand as Manfred followed him relentlessly, cutting the swollen skin that had begun to bag under his eye, hitting him in the mouth again and then again until his lips were distorted and lumpy. But it was though Manfred was inured to the sting of these blows now, and he did not alter the rhythm of punches nor slacken his attack. His brown fists, hardened by work at the winch and net, flipped Chasseur's hair as he ducked or hissed past his face as he ran backwards. Then one caught him a glancing blow on the temple, and Chasseur stopped aiming his own counterpunches and struggled merely to stay clear of those swinging fists, for his legs started to turn numb and heavy under him. Manfred was tireless, pressing him relentlessly, and despair combined with exhaustion to slow Chasseur's legs. A fist crashed into his ribs, and he grunted and staggered and saw the other fist coming at his face. He could not avoid it. His feet seemed planted in buckets of treacle, and he grabbed at Manfred's arm and hung on grimly. That was exactly what Manfred had been trying to force him to do, and he whipped his other arm around Chasseur's neck. "Now I've got you," he mumbled through swollen, bloody lips, as he forced Chasseur to double over, his head pinned under Manfred's left arm. Manfred lifted his right hand high and swung it in a brutal uppercut. Chasseur sensed rather than saw the fist coming, and twisted so violently that he felt as though his neck had snapped. But he managed to take the blow on the top of his forehead rather than in his unprotected face. The shock of it was driven like an iron spike from the top of his skull down his spine. He knew he could not take another blow like that.